This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Identifying bodies looks so easy on TV. Grab some missing person's data, clues from their forensics lab, a little DNA analysis, and you've got an ID before the first commercial break. Identifying real anonymous remains can take decades, if solved at all. The National Institute of Justice estimates that up to 40,000 unidentified body parts are stowed in police stations and coroner's offices across the country. Some become macabre versions of local celebrities. The Lady of the Dunes, The Boy in the Box, Princess Doe, Tent Girl. But with 4,000 more discovered each year, the majority of bodies remain unnamed, unburied, and uninvestigated. A growing posse of citizen investigators is picking up those cold cases. Using a network of websites and internet tools, thousands of amateurs endeavor to reunite unidentified remains with their names and their families. Science writer Deborah Halber wrote about some of the obstacles and triumphs for amateur sleuths now solving America's coldest cases in a new book called The Skeleton Crew. We asked her about one of the most well-known, Todd Matthews, a Tennessee factory worker who became a central figure in the web sleuth phenom. He solved the identity of Tent Girl, a mystery for some 30 years.
So Todd Matthews was a 17-year-old factory worker when he started chatting with his then-girlfriend's father, who had actually been the one to come across the body of this young woman wrapped up in what investigators thought looked like a carnival tent in 1968 in Kentucky. So this case was cold even then. Even when Todd was in high school, it was before he was born. But he somehow became obsessed with this young woman who, at the time, they thought may have been around his age. It just struck him as so unfair that she had never been reunited with her name. And he took it on as a kind of personal challenge. And he actually spent 10 years of his life. He flirted with bankruptcy, with divorce. His wife could never really understand how he could devote himself to this. But with the advent of the internet, he actually came across a posting on a bulletin board of a woman who'd been looking for her long-lost sister. And the posting had only a few words, a height around 5'2", dark hair, dark eyes, and last seen in Lexington, Kentucky. And he somehow just knew that he had actually found the relative of Tent Girl.
He solved the case in 1998, triggered a posse of like-minded amateur sleuths, people from all over the country, of all stripes, you know, people who were caring for their children at home, people who were doctors, one former news photographer who was quite jaded. By no means a unified group of amateur sleuths, but you met and talked to many of them who were tirelessly pursuing cases. Any common elements or motivations to those who were picking up these cases?
I think a lot of people who do this are driven by a mystery, driven by the puzzle. I think what happens over time is that they get connected to the victims, and certain ones resonate with certain people, and they almost adopt these cases as their own. And they feel like Todd did with Tent Girl. They just start feeling personally invested in a particular victim, and they just can't let it lie. So that's part of it. There is definitely the element of the mystery, the puzzle, the challenge. But there's also this very powerful, compassionate connection to the person and also the family, because they realize that the family members of these people don't know where they are. They are missing them every day. They don't know how to find them. And they feel very compelled by the altruistic aspect of trying to bring closure to some of these families.
Well, some of these sites like the Doe Network, the Cold Case Investigations, Web Sleuths, others, what kind of discussions and hints and work gets done on those sites?
Well, they all have slightly different methods. I spoke to one woman who swore by her method, which is to take the location of where the body was found and then start working outward in concentric circles geographically, looking for missing people. She feels that the body would be a missing person who was in a generally the same geographic area. That's not always the case. But one of the actually disturbing things that I found was that because of the nature of how law enforcement records are kept and cases are approached and the lack of information sharing sometimes over county lines or over state lines, a person could go missing in one county, turn up dead in the next county, and this is actually a case that I came across, and not be identified for 20 years. So that's where the web sleuths can make such a big difference, because they lend the eyeballs, the human ability to make leaps, to make connections, where the record keeping or the way things have been so far do not necessarily pan out.
Well, you portray this community, of course, a very diverse community, as a lot of untapped, unused brain power. But of course, it is an internet community, so there's plenty of sniping, plenty of mudslinging, and plenty of kind of commenting that may add to the impression that law enforcement often calls these people donuts, D-O-E, nuts, you know, obsessed
exactly.
with the John and Jane Does. Has law enforcement come to appreciate this kind of ground-up approach? Has it influenced their investigations or pushing cases forward?
Well, there's a big range of responses in the law enforcement community. I've spoken to those who do not really appreciate the work. They feel that information should not be shared with the public. But I've also talked to detectives increasingly who have come to rely on some of the web sleuths and appreciate their contributions. There's Detective Stuart Summershoe in Phoenix, Arizona, who has worked on several cases with input from the public, and he says that he could not have solved those cases without that input.
Deborah Halper is with us. She's talking about her new book, which is called Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. There is just such an interesting sort of union of a different kind of identities here, you know, these people who are helping to solve these crimes. But there's a kind of tragedy that many of these people are never reported missing. And one of the undercurrents I see in this book is something about the meaning of identity, about being missed, about being named, about having a dentist office come forward and say, yes, that person we know. What was revealed to you in the writing of this book about the meaning of identity?
Well, it's something that I think a lot of people, may probably most of us, take for granted. There are so many ways our identities are out there these days in social media. It feels like we couldn't possibly be separated from our identities. But in my research, I discovered that it's actually remarkably common to be separated from your identity, and it doesn't take that much, and it does happen fairly frequently. You know, a runner out without an ID, an accident victim, it happens all the time. And it's just something that people need to think about and maybe be aware that it's a bit of precaution you might take to just think of how somebody could find you, how somebody could get word back to your loved one.
There are so many stories in this book. One case in particular sticks out for me, one that ended up a head inside of a bucket, as gory as it sounds. Tell us a little bit about the backstory there.
So there was a truck stop in Missouri, and one day the truckers who were using the facility came across what looked like an ordinary white plastic bucket, but the bucket seemed to be filled with hardened concrete. And it turned out that the bucket actually contained a decapitated head that had been plunged into concrete, the concrete hardened around it. And so forensic experts were able to draw some conclusions about the victim. But it really took a web sleuth to solve this case. Ellen Leach in Mississippi was able to see a reconstruction of what the victim would have looked like. He looked like a middle-aged man with graying hair and blue eyes. And she then saw a photograph of a missing individual. And this process went on literally for years, but eventually her proposed match got through to the right people in law enforcement. It was investigated, and it turned out that she had helped identify a missing Iowa man who had been a victim of a horrific crime. And the ID came just in the nick of time for the murder trial, which was actually in progress in Iowa. Without the body, without that ID, prosecutors felt that they might not have gotten the conviction. But thanks to Ellen's quick thinking and her observation skills and her proposed match, it turned out that the jury was able to put the murderer behind bars for life.
And that is one of five solves by Ellen Leach, who came from a family who couldn't pay for higher education and worked at a supermarket steam table serving prepared foods. And there she is, solving a crime. One of those featured in Deborah Halber's new book, Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Deborah Halber, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Now, we do have a link to more on her website on the book, including a slideshow and a trailer of a documentary that's now in production about Todd Matthews. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, one way you can protect yourself from becoming a crime statistic is properly securing your front door. When Word of Mouth continues, the latest innovations in electronic security, keyless homes. That's after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over the past decade, much of the technology we touch or use every day has altered dramatically. The smartphone, for example, has made toting CD cases, cameras, notepads unnecessary, and address books and agendas all but obsolete. But still, we haul keys around. We stow them with neighbors, hide them under rocks, throw them down to visitors from apartment windows, and frequently wonder where the heck we put them. Several companies are busting into the keyless electronic home access market. Stephen Kurtz reports for the home section of the New York Times. He wrote an article called Losing the Key that covered innovations in the digital house key market. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the sales pitch for the electronic home entry market?
I think the sales pitch here is convenience. You know, this idea that, you don't have to worry about losing your keys anymore or as you said, finding them. But the other thing is, you know, you come home with a bag of groceries and you have to reach into your pocket, you know, and it's a pain. And then there's also the issue of house guests. You know, you have to go to the hardware store and make duplicate keys. And it's not expensive, but it's not really a fun process for anybody. And so the idea is that, you know, everything becomes seamless. You send out an electronic key, you know, to a guest or to, you know, a dog walker or the plumber, that sort of thing. And, you know, and they can access your home and you don't have any of the hassle of dealing with keys.
And you do this through your phone, your tablet, computer, that kind of thing?
Yes, exactly. So you get, you get an app. The lock is equipped to kind of, in many cases, a few of them are more advanced than others. But in most cases, you get a password. So you get the app, you download the app, and then that password becomes a kind of digital key. And you're giving that password out to the plumber or to your kids or whoever else needs access, and then you can also revoke that password. So the plumber doesn't have access to your house beyond when the term, you know, the time frame that you set.
So there are some recognizable names, Slage, Kwikset, setting up these digital keys. A few other companies also getting into the game. Tell us a little bit about Kisi, K-I-S-I, I don't know, Keezy?
Yeah, Keezy, yes, that's it, Keezy. So that's an interesting one. That's they're coming from a tech perspective, so it's a couple guys, they're German. And they came up with the idea. They said they were at Oktoberfest in Germany, and they had some friends coming into town, And they were at this festival and realized there was no way they could get across town and give them a key to their place. And so they started brainstorming and coming and thinking about, well, you know, how could we get our friends a key, and we don't have to, you know, if we can't get to them the inconvenience of them coming to us. So they came up with this idea of Keezy, which works similar to the other ones. It has a passcode. And what they're targeting urbanites, and they're targeting the front door of large apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. So they would put the Keezy technology, which works. The nice thing about Keezy is that you don't have to replace the lock. It overrides the existing intercom or lock system. And so once the main door is equipped with Keezy and everybody in that apartment building can access the main door, then they hope to move into each individual apartment.
Yeah, a few years ago, I used to live in New York, and I got my backpack stolen with my keys. Everybody in the entire apartment building had to get new keys. And so I imagine that you say that this is urban, but I would say even a market among landlords, building managers, that kind of thing.
Exactly. That is who they're targeting right now. The other ones that I talk about and write about and the piece, you know, the Kivo from Kwikset, they're targeting homeowners. Right now, Keezy is going after landlords and big property managers, or, you know, someone who owns a townhouse or a brownstone and has a couple of tenants. But eventually they'll get into the market, I think, of going after the apartment dwellers themselves.
Now, would people still use a mechanical key, or would this be entirely digital?
You know, the people I talk to, so far, in almost every case, there's still the mechanical lock. You know, if your cell phone battery dies, or if there's a Wi-Fi outage or something like that, you still have the key. I mean, to me, it defeats the purpose a little bit. The idea is that you have this sort of magical way to get into your place now. The point is you don't want to carry around the key anymore. But in many of these instances, the lock is still there. A strong deadbolt. I talked to a locksmith who uses this himself. He uses the Schlage, the touchscreen deadbolt, but he has a backup deadbolt as well.
Well, you just brought up some vulnerabilities. What if your smartphone gets stolen? What if your battery dies? Or, as happened to many people after Superstorm Sandy, there's no Wi-Fi signal, no power.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I think I've been doing a few of these kinds of stories for the home section about, the Internet of Things and home automation. And for a lot of people, the key is a maybe a minor hassle, but at the same time, you know, there's no instruction manuals necessary. You're never going to be a concern about a power outage. When I asked the guys from Keezy what to do in the case of their cell phone battery dying, they suggested, you know, going to a nearby Starbucks and recharging it, which didn't seem like, you know, the best option. That, to me, is not much different than the pain of losing your key.
Mm. Stephen Kurtz is with us from the New York Times home section. We're talking about the emerging market of digital house keys. Keys are so symbolic and laden with metaphor, and you write about some of these meanings in our culture. What might we lose, Stephen, in a keyless world?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there are a lot, like you said, you know, from phraseology, you know, the idea of the latchkey kid, we're back in the 70s, the key party, the ritual of a mayor presenting the key to the city. When I started reporting, I thought I would talk to a lot of people, or at least some people, who had a kind of fondness for the key. I mean, this is a technology that goes back to the Egyptians and even before then. But when I talked to people, it didn't seem like they had much affection for the key. A lot of people find the key to be a pain, and then the more complicated your life gets, you know, you've got a key for your bike lock, a key for your house, a key for your car. So, you know, I talked to one guy, this guy Don Norman, who's a, you know, academic and writes a lot about design. And I talk specifically about that ritual, you know, when you're in a new relationship, of giving the key to, you know, your romantic partner. And it's a big moment, I think, for a lot of people. And he said that for him, he felt that the emotion in that act comes from the exchange, the emotion does not come from the actual physical key. So in the future, you may give them a passcode, and it may still contain the meeting, just without the physical object.
And of course, you don't have to get it back if things go sour.
That's right. That's right.
Well, Stephen Kurtz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Kurtz wrote the article, Losing the Key. He's a reporter for the New York Times Home section. We do have a link to the article, which will provide a much broader picture of this interesting new market. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.
Losing lots of keys lately. I don't know what that means, but maybe I'll be better off with things.
So much for keeping intruders out. Up next, we'll hear a story of keeping a wild animal in. We're going to talk about a kind of love affair between a tawny owl and the man who took care of her for 15 years. That's right after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the owl and the pussycat to Harry Potter's Hedwig, the owl is solidly perched in the hearts and imaginations of children and adults alike. They're adorable. Who wouldn't want one as a pet? They're also fierce, with the sharp talons and instincts of carnivorous birds of prey. When Martin Windrow first laid his eyes on a tawny owl about the size of a loaf of bread, it was love at first sight. He named her Mumble and began a 15-year relationship. After writing and editing numerous books on military history, Martin's latest book is about life with Mumble in a London apartment and later a village in the south of England. It is called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. And Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Now, maybe we should start with a little primer on tawny owls. How big are they? What do they eat?
Well, loaf of bread is pushing it a bit, unless it's quite a small loaf of bread. I guess when they're sitting in their usual fat, comfortable-looking squat, they are about 9 inches high. If you could see them stretched out without that thick layer of feathers, they would be about, nearly twice as much as that. As to what they eat, in a state of nature, they would eat any kind of small rodent. Mice, rats, voles, right up to small rabbits sometimes. But they often, when they can't get hold of a warm meal like that, they'll eat worms, beetles, insects. They're pretty eclectic as far as their diet goes. They'll take whatever's around.
And they like the fur and the feathers on top of it.
Sure, they need that to make their insides work wrong.
Now, Mumble was your second round of owl companionship. What happened the first time around?
The first time was a dreadful mistake. I got a little owl. That's a breed, not a description. But the problem was it had already been born, if you will, and had lived for its first 6 months in a big aviary with other birds. So it was untamable. The trick, of course, with all wild animals is that if you want to tame them, you have to get them as young as possible. And the difference with Mumble was that, having learned my lesson, I ordered an egg before it was even laid. But the little owl, that was pretty much a nightmare. Mm-hmm. It was very frustrating. And eventually, she escaped. And my feelings were pretty mixed about that, I got to admit.
Well, you named the owl Wellington, a rather imperious-looking thing.
And it was indeed, yes. It had a fierce stare, which it turned on me with utter contempt whenever I tried to feed her by hand or anything like that.
You compared that relationship much more to prisoner and captor. But then you went through the significant hurdles, by the way, of getting the owl egg that became Mumble. Tell us, please, about that moment that you say was love at first sight when you first saw Mumble.
My brother, who's a falconer and who lived in the country, he had organized it for me. I had ordered the egg, and for the first month or so out of the egg, Mumble had been hand-fed, several times a day by the breeder's little boy. I was expecting, of course, to find, you know, a cardboard box with a frightened scuttling noise inside it. But instead, I just walked into the farm kitchen, and there it was, sitting on the back of a chair in the sunshine. It was then, I don't know, about 6 inches high. It was a ball of gray fluff with two huge black eyes, and I walked towards it, sort of half expecting it to be frightened and to back off or scuttle away, but it didn't. It just looked at me, and something very strange happened inside me, and that was it.
I love your description, shaped rather like a plump toy penguin with a nose job.
Yeah.
Did you know, Martin, what you were getting into having a wild animal in the house?
No, of course not. I was full of dumb enthusiasm, and so every day was full of surprises, and mostly they were delightful, apart, of course, from the fact that you can't house train an owl. And that was complicated, but it was so rewarding. I don't know if you've ever kept a kitten. Well, this was like having a kitten that was teaching itself to fly.
Well, I never had a kitten that I had to lay down newspapers throughout the entire house in order to protect.
Sure.
Now, but why an owl? I mean, that's a question. Why an owl?
Well, I can't answer that, Virginia. I mean, my only reply to people who were astonished by this was, why not? Listen, I'll come out with my hands up. She was just so damn cute. And it just kept on getting cuter and getting more and more interesting.
Well,
I'm not an ornithologist. I never have been, even an amateur. But living with Mumble prompted me to get, you know, to hit the books and find out more about tawny owls.
Well, there is so much in your book about the evolution of the owl and of human beings concurrently. But ultimately, to me, it's a story of a couple. You know, you're settled into your various different routines of being a couple. I wonder if that ever got in the way of other companionship. I mean, do you ever bring dates over?
Second only to the, what should we say, the hygienic problems, there was the fact that for the first, 2, 3, 4 months, she was as friendly towards visitors as she was towards me. You know, she'd let them pick her up on their hands and stroke her and make cooing noises, and she was just fine with that. Once she'd mastered flying, I began to have to warn friends. On more than one occasion, I had to actually issue steel helmets, which I happened to have lying around, being a military historian, because she would tend to land on top of people's heads and her claws. Oh, there was no malice there. It was just a landing spot, but her claws are quite sharp.
Well, she did love to perch on your shoulder, and apparently it's hardwired for tawny owls to want to sit next to things.
Well, yeah.
Are there other observations, though, of Mumble's instincts in captivity? For example, did she ever try to get away like Wellington did?
No, she never did. On one memorable night, I foolishly left a window open a crack too wide, and then I went out to the movies, and when I got back, she was gone. And the next few hours weren't much fun. But the story had a happy ending because she didn't try and fly away. She just sat on a ledge on the outside of the apartment block. And eventually, I was able, by, you know, waving her supper at the sky, to tempt her to come back down to me. And she hopped in her basket quite happily. We all think cats are full of affection, and we all suspect that they just come at chow time. Mumble obviously liked her grub, and that was our initial relationship. But she did seem to have a capacity for affection. She would come over to me and deliberately get up close, and shove her head against my nose like a cat rubbing itself.
The she we're talking about is Mumble the Owl, the subject, along with Martin Windrow, my guest, of a new book called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. It chronicles his 15-year relationship with the tawny owl. You kept a journal throughout your time with Mumble, but waited for years to put the experience down in writing. Why did you wait?
Well, the way she finally died, too early, she had years of happy life in her yet, was because some damn fool broke into the aviary in the middle of the night and tried to let her out, or tried to steal her, I don't know which, and she had an instant heart attack, and that was it.
Mm.
So, in the immediate aftermath of that, I was very angry, because this was senseless, and I was sad. And so I put the notebooks and the photographs on one side, and I got on with my life, you know. And it just so happened that a couple of years ago I came to a gap in work, and I pulled out the notebooks and thought, well, let's have a look. And, of course, after all that time, I'd forgotten what I wrote, so it all came rushing back.
The book begins with a note from the Hawk and Owl Trust strongly discouraging people from taking in wild owls as pets. Anything that you'd like to add, Martin, to that caution? Or, you know,
yeah,
a lot of people wish to have wild animals thinking that they can access some part of their wisdom or nature. What can you add?
My first and overwhelming thing is don't capture a wild animal. Because what you're doing is taking it out of its natural environment, its established relationships, and imprisoning it. You have to be just about the first thing the animal sees, or certainly as soon as it's safe for it to leave its mother. That's what's necessary to form the bond. I had no idea what she saw me as. I mean, originally, obviously, I was mom, because I was doing the feeding. After that, I suppose I was her mate, because we were sharing a territory which she would defend. I really don't know what was going on in her head, but she seemed to like me, and she seemed to like living with me, so I didn't bother to analyze it any further than that.
Martin Windrow, longtime military editor for Osprey Publishing and author of several books on military history, his latest takes a turn and recounts his 15-year relationship with a tawny owl named Mumble. It's called The Owl Who Liked Sitting on Caesar. Martin Windrow, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Now, you can find a link to an excerpt from the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Like Martin Windrow, many of us think of our pets as family members. So we mourn them as family when they die. If you live in a city apartment, you can't just go bury them in your backyard. Parisians can go to an animal cemetery just north of the city. It is the oldest of its kind in the world and houses the remains of hundreds of beloved dogs, cats, birds, even horses. And it's still very much in use today. Sarah Elzas brings us a story.
The Cimetière des Chiens is on the banks of the Seine River as it curves north of Paris. When you go through the arched stone entrance, it's like going into any other Parisian cemetery, except the tombstones are smaller.
Here's a cat, has a picture of it, it's an orange tabby, and it says, Le temps passera, mais tu resteras ma doudoune. It means time passes, but you will always be my doudoune, 1991 to 2002. Here's just a flat tombstone, Notre Iago, our Iago, 1973 to 1983.
There are live cats walking around, lying on tombstones. Many of the graves look as though their human caretakers are still around. They're tidy, covered in flowers and trinkets. This is to Ramses, 1982 to 1992. I think it's a cat. Pattes et mains jointes, nous avons vécu 9 années et demie d'amour. Our hands and our paws joined, we lived 9.5 years of love. Que ton absence est cruelle et dure à supporter. Your absence is cruel and hard to stand. Que Dieu nous aide. May God help us. Pour toujours dans mon cœur. Forever in my heart. Signed, ta maman, your mother. It's easy to mock this outpouring of grief over what some say are just animals, but people tend to personify their pets and grieve accordingly when they die. Gérard Faburel takes care of pet funerals for the mortuary Mercier & Sons up the street from the pet cemetery. People who come to him are those who've had a particular relationship with their pets, he says.
Pratiquement une relation humaine.
Almost a human relationship. For some, losing a pet is like losing a child. You can see this on what people have written on the stones in the cemetery. Faburel, who has two cats himself, says people tend to see their pets as idealized human beings.
Un animal, on n'a jamais rarement quelque chose à lui reprocher dans sa vie.
It's rare to hold a grudge against an animal, he says. Plus, an animal doesn't contradict you and always needs you.
Alors là, vous voyez les cercueils, hein, ce sont
he shows the small coffins available for cats and dogs. He arranges everything from picking up the animal from home or the vet, arranging for a coffin and a headstone, and getting the cemetery plot.
Là, c'est le modèle de luxe, si on peut dire, avec un poignet, une poignée métal.
This is a fancy coffin, he says, with metal handles. They start at about 200 euros and can go to 500 or more for larger ones. A cemetery plot starts at 116 euros a year. Cemetery workers fill in the grave of a cat named Pepette that died a few days earlier. Her small coffin was placed in a tomb that already houses two other animals. Their owner, a doctor wearing dark glasses, says she wants her pets buried in the ground because she has a connection with the earth. There wasn't a ceremony, she just watched the workers fill in the dirt. She then showed me a photo of her cat on her mobile phone.
Je vais la regarder pour la première fois depuis jeudi avec vous.
This is the first time she's looking at the photo since the cat died.
Pepette dans les fleurs.
Pepette in the flowers. Standing amidst the tombstones, we look at photos of a black and white cat on a patio. Funeral director Faburel says that all kinds of people come to him to bury their pets, not just older people thinking of their own mortality or rich people with money to burn.
C'est vraiment tout le monde, tout le monde, hein,
it's really everyone, jeunes, old and young, rich and not so rich, he says. And in the cemetery, amidst all the family pets, you do get the famous one or two.
Here is Rin Tin Tin, la grande vedette du cinéma, the big movie star.
Rin Tin Tin is the German shepherd who appeared in films in the 1930s. It's said that composer Camille Saint-Saëns and director Sacha Guitry's pets are buried here too. This is Sarah Elzis in Agnières-sur-Seine, just north of Paris.
Five years ago, James Cameron blew audiences away with his 3D film Avatar. Word of mouth continues with a look into what may be the next big thing in immersive cinema, virtual reality, and 360-degree filmmaking. That's after the break, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this year, we reported on Facebook's acquisition of the virtual reality company Oculus Rift. Used mostly for video games, a player puts on the Oculus headset and headphones and is immersed in the virtual world of a game, surrounded by 360 degrees of it. Now movie makers are getting in on the virtual reality movement, more specifically, horror movie makers. Here with the gory details is Neil Ungerleiter, reporter for Fast Company, where he wrote about what it's like to shoot a feature film for Oculus Rift. Neil, always a pleasure to catch up with what you're doing.
Thanks, Virginia. Happy to be here.
So begin with the product or the end-user experience. What is it like to watch a horror movie with an Oculus Rift headset on?
Really freaky to get down to the meat and bones of it. You put on the helmet and you're surrounded by this movie where you see a bad guy by you. You see someone who's hurt and your brain doesn't know whether it's real life or a movie, which even though you know it's fake, does make it a profoundly weird experience. But then making it even weirder is the fact that because your field of vision is 360 degrees and the movie's playing in front of you, to your sides, and in the back of you, it's kind of like real life and you don't know where to look.
Oh, so you could look up and see the sky, you could look down and see your feet?
The scene I saw in the helmet took place in a shed. And you look up, you see the ceiling, you look down, you see your feet, and you really don't know where to look. And the only way to know where to look is to have audio cues. Your helmet includes headphones, you have sounds in your left ear and your right ear. their surround sound, like real life, basically. Mm-hmm. So the directors and the writers of the movie have to account for where the sounds go to train the viewer to move their eyes, which creates a whole new challenge and a whole new difficulty for actually making the film.
All right, so I'd love to get into the guts of that, but first let me ask you, I mean, it sounds like you're in a video game, but it's almost even scarier in some way. Is the experience interactive or more like watching a movie? So, for example, you know, if you heard those footsteps creeping up behind you, would you turn around to see who's approaching or just be still and watch the scene unfold?
That's the interesting thing. Honestly, the movie I saw, Black Mass, if it was on a regular movie screen, it would just be a regular B movie.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be, but because you're wearing this helmet and it's virtual reality, your reflexes take over. When you hear footsteps behind you, you think, oh, someone's walking behind me. I better turn around. And then you see a maniac with a knife. And even though you can't interact with the movie in any way besides moving your head around, you really do feel like you're basically trapped inside a video game and something very bad is about to happen to you.
So if I were to watch you watching this...
It's not for everyone.
If I were to watch you watching this, Neil, would you be moving around a room?
You're not able to move around the room yet.
You
right
just sit
now,
in one place.
Exactly. You sit. I stood when I did it. Mm-hmm. I think most people would stand just to feel closer physically to the character in the movie.
All right. So let's go back to this short called Black Mass. Sounds like a horror film, certainly. How does it work to make it? I mean, if the viewer can look in any direction, you must have to be filming everywhere with everything going on in the periphery or off screen, as they say. How do they do it?
It's a huge technical challenge. When I went to see the movie, they were using cameras produced by a startup in California called Jaunt that's making cameras for virtual reality systems. And the camera, it has all these little lenses on it. They look in all different directions. And they do a real take of everything 360 degrees in the camera. So the camera is basically where you are in the movie. And the camera picks up everything because it's 360 degrees. You can't edit out microphones. You can't edit out light stands or technical equipment. The directors have to find a way to hide everything, which is a huge technical challenge. At the same time, for the actors inside the movie, it's almost like being a play because everything has to be done in one take.
And right, because you're merging all sorts of, you're basically stitching this together.
Exactly. You're stitching it together essentially from dozens of different cameras to create one view, and to do different takes of it and stitch them together would be both crazy, crazy expensive for the companies, and would take manpower that honestly less than 500 people in the world know how to do right now.
Wow. Anything beyond a short in the works now?
That's the million-dollar question. A while ago, James Cameron said he was interested in doing a feature film for the Oculus Rift. Also, there's a documentary coming out called Zero Point that's going to be for Oculus. And it's supposed to be a documentary all about the history of virtual reality. But because Oculus Rift still hasn't been released to the public yet, we still don't know when it'll actually be in homes. We don't know even how movies will be sold for this, whether you'll go online to buy them through Facebook, whether Facebook will set up a separate site and a separate service. That's still a big, big question. Or even having kind of red box boxes in your local mall. We just don't know yet. And I think in terms of making a full-length movie, people are waiting to see what people actually want to see, how it can be done before jumping in. And Black Mass, I should stress, is only going to be a 5 to 8 minute short movie, but it's still going to be a really exciting way of showing, hey, we can do this really cool, really scary stuff for Oculus, and maybe there's some real money in this.
Well, Neil Ungerleider, must have been quite an experience. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thanks, Virginia. Happy to be here.
Neil Ungerleiter, reporter for Fast Company. He covers the intersection of technology and everyday life. You can find a link to his article and read more about what it's like to shoot a feature film for Oculus Rift at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to listen to and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. The most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.